Little surfer, little one, made my heart come all undone. Do you love me? Do you, surfer girl? My little surfer girl, I have watched you on the shore. Standing by the ocean's roar, do you love me? Do you, surfer girl?
You're listening to Queer Voices on KPFT, and this segment is called Queer Music Heritage. I'm J.D. Doyle, and I started the show with a recording I just love, Frank's version of Surfer Girl. Frank is spelled P-H-R-A-N-C, and this year marks the 20th anniversary of her debut album called Folk Singer. She's recorded four other albums over the years, each filled with her own brand of humor and political commentary. I was delighted to get to see her perform in Houston last month and to interview her. You'll hear that interview and a lot more of her music, including two unreleased songs, in the second half of the show. But I'm starting off with another interview, with someone I've admired for years. And this segment is unusual because her interview is among the very few that I've featured that is with someone who is not primarily known as a performer. But I think she's made many contributions to our GLBT society in general, and in particular, she's been an important force on the women's music scene for decades. Her name is Toni Armstrong Jr. Her activism has covered many areas, and in 1997, she was inducted into the Chicago Gay and Lesbian Hall of Fame. I could go on for several minutes describing her talents and contributions over the years, but I want to focus on why I first became aware of her. My listeners no doubt know by now that I'm an avid collector of GLBT music, and I love exploring its history. And most of the time, researching that history is very difficult. Because ours is not a mainstream culture, the usual books and reference guides are not available. I've found that I have to rely heavily on newspapers and magazines that were issued during the early years of our music, and those are not readily available sources. So I was delighted when I discovered a publication called Hotwire. Its full name is Hotwire, the Journal of Women's Music and Culture, and was published from 1984 until 1994. To a researcher, this is a marvelous magazine. It expertly documented women's music during those years with its well-written, scholarly, and entertaining articles and numerous photographs. Information about the music of independent artists is hard to capture, so I was delighted to have such a resource. Toni Armstrong Jr. was the publisher of Hotwire, so I felt that she was in an ideal position to comment on the culture. So I interviewed her last June in Chicago when I was there for the Out Music Awards. And for background music, I've been using a song by one of the founding mothers of women's music, Margie Adam, from her Naked Keys album. Toni, you've been observing it, writing about it, and taking photos of it from its beginning. So you're in an ideal position to tell us, what is women's music?
If you line up 2,000 people and ask them what is women's music, you're going to get about 1,500 different answers. But the working definition that I've always used in my work is that it's woman-identified music. Possibly lesbian, possibly feminist, possibly something about your mother or your sister or your female coworker or the politics of women farmers. Never anti-feminist, never anti-gay, and never racist or oppressive in some way. Music by women, about women, and mostly for women.
Has that definition changed?
The definition of women's music, I don't think, has changed, but I think it has, with every passing six-month period since the 70s, grown to encompass something different. It started out very, very small, with a handful of artists that people could name, and with only a couple of different festivals, the National Women's Music Festival in 1974, the Michigan Women's Music Festival started in 75. There was actually another little one in 74 called a Woman's Sphere in D.C. that was started by the National Park Service all over the place. But they were very small. With every explosive jump, something else was being Me too, me too, me too, include me. Include jazz, include classical, include hip-hop, include different races, include different class things, include women from other countries, on and on and on. And so every time there was something different going on, the definition perhaps altered itself a little bit.
So in the beginning, it was white women with guitars.
The false impression, and I think it's been perpetrated for some good reasons and for some bad reasons, is that women's music from its beginning was essentially white, a few white women with guitars, maybe a piano, probably from California, singing folk music. And my experience from the mid-70s forward is that certainly there were those entertainers, but it was always so much more. I think there have always been bands involved, rock bands, ethnic bands, choruses, certainly women of color, and women of color have been integral to women's music from the very beginning. Linda Tillery, Deidre McCalla, Jane Sapp was there, Sweet Honey in the Rock, Judith Castleberry, on and on and on, Carolyn Brandy. I mean, I could literally reel off probably 30 names easily. Rock bands like Fanny and Deadly Nightshade, bands like Gwyn Yai, and have always been a part. Now, why then does everybody think it's white women with guitars? Well, partially because the only people who could really afford to go on tour were women who were extremely portable in their act. So if you had an instrument that you could carry, you didn't need a huge sound system, you didn't need to buy airline tickets for six other people in your band, then you probably were going to get out on the road. Certainly class has a lot to do with it. Who had the money, who had visibility. You can't, you know, begin to tease out the racism from the whole thing. Of course, we live in a racist culture, so I think that feminists everywhere, and certainly women's music culture, has had its share of racism. There's no getting around that, but it also deserves a lot of credit for women, white women, thinking about privilege, thinking about anti-racism work, taking a lead in anti-racism work, and women of color being willing to step forward and take leadership and teach, and be patient and make things happen collaboratively in a way that I don't see so much going on in most other parts of the world. And I think that women's music lyrics have at times really addressed racism issues from a very feminist perspective. A good example of that would be the song I Black Woman by Faith Nolan.
Faith Nolan's song, I Black Woman, came from her Freedom to Love album from 1989. I wonder if folk music got more attention in the beginning because, as a genre, folk lends itself more to political comments and being more lyrically lesbian.
There certainly was the element that folk music tended to incorporate more political lyrics. But by the time women's music came along in the mid-70s, really got going with festivals and the publications and things like that, I think that the political folk music was really fading from the scene and pop music was more coming in. So a lot of the music that came out in the early days of women's music wasn't even all that political. If we were to go through the festival sets and look at the music that was performed, if we were to go through all of the albums, look through all of the lyrics, we see certainly an explosion of political, explicitly feminist, explicitly lesbian lyrics in certain places, but certainly not throughout. And as we moved into the 80s, there was less and less and less and less of it.
Why do you think it became less?
That's been a constant question, I think, over the decades for those of us working in the industry. Some of it was that women were trying to make it more in the mainstream. So they were doing things that sounded much more professional. Their lyrics were getting much more general. I think, too, that the wider women's music became as an actual thing, as an industry, there were more and more women who wanted to be part of it, who may or may not be driven by those early visions of, you know, woman space and feminism as really a driving kind of an urge. They wanted to make music, and there was an audience for them, and they were good. So the festival producers invited them to come, and the audiences enjoyed them, and it just got bigger and bigger, and hundreds of recordings and performers became involved with it. And as such, it got diluted in terms of the politics, but it also became much more of a force to be reckoned with sheer numbers, became much more diverse across the board. Barbara Giddings, who's one of the most amazing pioneers of the gay rights movement, and I once had a conversation about whether it's better to focus all your attention in one place politically and have everybody pull on the same rope, basically, or everybody kind of out there doing their own thing without all pulling together. And her opinion was it's much better for everybody to be doing their own thing because the opposition can then smash a few of you, but not everybody. And I think that women's music ended up being like that. It was a million different things to a million different people. And where did the politics go? It's very interesting. We parallel what happened in the culture at large as we moved into the 80s.
So really, it's almost two questions. Did the artists become more closeted, or did the politics change?
I think the politics changed, and I think some artists always were kind of closeted. And I think that other ones who were pretty out there in the beginning maybe found other things to do with their lives and didn't continue all the way through to the year 2005 being entertainers. Meg Christian, for example, who was one of the major voices in the beginning in the early 80s, became more spiritual and withdrew completely from the whole public entertainment sphere. Who knows what kinds of political commentary she would have made had her life taken a different turn. Also, something that performer friends have talked to me about privately is that the coming out process is a complex and scary one, particularly in the 70s and 80s. I think it's a little bit easier now in the new millennium, but still scary for many. And that there's a high cost to be paid for explicitly identifying yourself as lesbian or gay or even feminist. If you really want to make your living doing music. And I think that that's a very legitimate point. There's a private aspect to that and a public aspect. And the private aspect is maybe they're still in the middle of their own coming out process. So how are they supposed to get on stage and, you know, be waving a rainbow flag when they're not even really sure themselves what's happening privately for them? So there's that aspect. There's others who really did feel that their private life was more private. They just wanted their music to be liked for what it was. And then there were the ones, and I love them, and they are the backbone of the women's music industry, not just the entertainers, but the writers and the producers and everyone who, when it was risky, they were willing to step up to the plate and say, way better that you hate me for who I am than love me for who I'm not, and I'm going to keep it real. And part of this whole thing is that women need to be on the stage singing about women. Not always lesbian, but women for sure. And, you know, bless them.
What women's music artist was the first that you became aware of?
The first women's music artist I ever heard was Meg Christian, and I think that it's a Meg, Chris Holly, Kay Gardner, Alex Dobkin toss-up for many when you think of classic women's music. Although by 1980, we're looking at other women, certainly like Mary Watkins and Linda Tillery and Vicki Randall and a lot of other people in the mix. So for me personally, when I was still in college, somebody brought a Meg Christian album and said, oh, you have to listen to this song about the gym teacher. And that was that.
She was a big, tough woman, the first to come along that showed me being female meant just still could. Yep.
course, that was a little of Mae Christian's Ode to a Gym Teacher, one of the first classic lesbian songs. That came from Meg's debut album in 1974 called I Know You Know. What was your first involvement with publications about women's music?
My first involvement with publication that had to do with women's music was reading a magazine called Paid My Dues, which was started in 1974 in Milwaukee by a woman named Dorothy Dean, who, interestingly enough, went on to become the Milwaukee County Treasurer. And it was a journal of women and music, not really women's music because it didn't really exist yet. And it really focused on the role of women in music, different things like band leaders, whatever. So there were a group of women in Chicago in about 77 who wanted to take over publication. I happened to be in on that conversation and said, oh, yeah, that sounds great. So between 77 and 80, I was involved with Paid My Dues. Now, also in 1977, it was clear to me from my first festival on that this was a really, really amazing kind of a life-changing thing that was going on, and that if only it could be more organized, everybody would move ahead a lot faster. So I started a trade directory called We Shall Go Forth, which I published on and off from 77 to 95, which listed performers and coffee houses and bookstores and publications and things like that.
Paid My Dues wasn't the first music women's publication.
Paid My Dues wasn't the first of the publications, but it certainly was the first to come out in a sort of a magazine journal format, covering what was soon to become called women's music, if we could say it that way. There were some other smaller newsletters around before, like Musica by Indy Allen, which came out of Oregon. There was a directory of women's media that was small. And in the mid-70s, there were different publications that were coming out around the country. For example, my sister's song discography from Milwaukee, something called Calliope, which was a newsletter of the Feminist Radio Network, came from Washington, D.C. There was Clara, a newsletter that was a research of history of women in music. Heresies, a feminist publication on art and politics from New York. So things were happening all over the place. And a really seminal organization was the Women's Institute for Freedom of the Press, which was started by Donna Allen, Indy Allen's mom. Her position really was that women had no access to the media. They were systematically blocked from any of their issues being reported, and that if women had more access to the media, things would change. And boy, she was sure right.
After Paid My Dues ended, there was a gap between when Hotwire started. Could you lead us up to the beginning of Hotwire?
It's interesting because Hotwire really was a separatist magazine, but it's rarely identified as such because it didn't have any of the angry rhetoric that is often ascribed to the separatist movement. However, we never printed anything, even pictures if we could avoid it, by men. We never covered anything that had men in it. It was all put together by women, every single thing, including the mailing, putting on the stamps, all the writing, all everything.
I never did get a separatist feeling from it.
It absolutely was a separatist publication. And much of women's music at the time really was aimed at separatism. One of the things that is kind of entertaining when I look back at how history, you know, remembers what happened, the folklore as it's being generated, is that separatism was all about, you know, angry, man-hating kind of energy. And my experience of it during those decades was it really was sort of the kinder, gentler separatism of just putting energy into promoting women and empowering women. And it wasn't anything about wanting to take away men's power or say bad things about them. It was about, you know, if we have room for 5 articles, let's make them all be by, for, and about women. I remember writer Jewel Gomez, being on a talk show, Sally Jesse Raphael, if memory serves, and she said, she was asked, why do you hate men? And she said, I don't hate men. I hate the patriarchy. And I think that that's pretty much what separatism in all its forms was about. There was a real sense in the 70s, too, of we're young, we're all in it together, we're all against the patriarchy. Oh my God, there's other lesbians. How great is that? Oh, we're going to be able to sing songs about lesbians and women. How great is that? One of the songs that I've always liked was Teresa Trull's You're My Home, which she wrote about Olivia Records from her Let It Be Known album.
You're my home.
Can you think of artists who were more vocal in their separatism?
Of course, Alex Dobkin and Sirani Avedis / Sally Piano come to mind in terms of separatist things. Whenever media has covered women's music, which has not been very much over the years, I might point out, it's like that old story of the blind men touching the elephant and one saying, oh, an elephant is like a leaf. Oh, an elephant is like a snake. Oh, an elephant is like a tree trunk. Only really experiencing one little part of it and then claiming to be talking about all of women's music. Very difficult. So you have, for example, on the one side, the very radical separatist artists like Linda Scheer, Alex Dobkin, Lynn Daniels, the festival producer who did the East Coast Lesbians Festival, and everyone who not only... It wasn't just for women and it wasn't just for lesbians. If you were not a lesbian, you couldn't be a craftswoman. You couldn't be a worker. You couldn't be an entertainer there. I mean, really very hard line. All the way up to things like Hot Wire magazine, which was just really just about women. Still separatist, but minus that. And there's always an internal debate about whether or not separatism is helping or hurting. Helping or hurting. And that has been like a 30-year conversation. Now, of course, we have all of the mess up in Michigan with Camp Trans attacking Michigan all the time. And it's interesting to me because since Michigan has started, it has always been under attack by somebody who didn't like what it was, what it was doing, who it appealed to, always. So this is just really the latest in a long string of people being upset whenever an oppressed group says, you know what, it's my right to start whatever event I want for myself and my people. I don't want your money, I don't want your help, and I don't want your input. I just want to do this for myself. And the reality is woman-born women are still an oppressed group in this world. Transgender people, extremely oppressed group. But how are these things incompatible? Why does it have to be an argument between these two groups? It's really quite maddening.
Okay, we've talked about how Hotwire started. What we haven't talked about is what it was.
Hotwire was a publication from... We started it in 1984. We stopped it in 1994. We put out 30 issues. Came out 3 times a year, and it was devoted to covering women's music and culture. It had several major objectives. We wanted to print a lot of photos. We wanted to cover festivals. We wanted to have writers like... the feminist writers' input as well, not just in writing articles that are journalistic, but also talking about feminist writing, feminist theater, all of these things. Trying to pull together artists who would appreciate each other's work. For example, one of my favorite songs of all time from women's music is called Where Will You Be? It's a song by Nedra Johnson, who was very inspired by the work of Audre Lorde, Pat Parker, and other African-American feminist writers, and she wrote that song based on that.
Where will you be when they come? Are you gonna stand by me when they come? Your silence won't protect you.
It was it was always amazing to me that the filmmakers didn't know the musicians, and occasionally films would get made and filmmakers would ask me, well, you know, do you know of any music that would be appropriate? And it's like, wow, there's like 20 songs that would be great for that. And they hadn't heard of even one of these artists. So Hotwire tried to bring to be a forum for people to find each other and really read about each other's work. One of the editorial decisions that we made in the beginning that I'm so glad about now is not to print anything that was ever critical. So we didn't do album reviews. We didn't critique events. What our mission was to let everybody say what they're doing and why, and then let the reader make their own decisions if they liked that or they didn't like that. I really feel like we stayed on very neutral ground about almost everything at all times, and that was very helpful because there was so much infighting in the industry, as there, of course, would be. It would have been better for sales had we gone the more tabloid route, but we really took the high road every step of the way, I think, all the way to the end with that.
How did you decide on the name Hotwire?
It comes from a poem written by Yvonne Zipter that's actually an erotic poem called Finding the Hotwire. So when younger women fantasize that, you know, the old crunchy granola dykes, which we're all dismissed as, are not sex positive, and I just laugh. It's like, oh, girls, you have no idea.
Your first cover story was on Kate Clinton.
Yes, our first cover was on Kate Clinton, and our very last cover was on Suzanne Westenhofer, and that felt very good bookends to do the comedians.
Roughly what percent of the artists covered over the years were lesbian?
Well over half the artists in the magazine were lesbian. The vast majority, in fact, way more than half, as I'm thinking about it, they were either lesbian or very specifically lesbian-friendly, like Judith Sloan, for example, very gay positive. Certainly when you're starting to include every woman who's played in a band, you know, we're exponentially increasing the number, and who knows about all of them. But none of them were anti-gay in any way or anti-feminist.
Tell us about the sound sheets. I think they were in a way revolutionary. It wasn't the first use of sound sheets in a magazine, of course, but to be used by a minority culture to get their culture out there was revolutionary.
I agree. I think that was one of the best ideas ever, was to put in these little flexi discs that we would literally, by hand, staple into the back of every magazine. And it was an opportunity. What we did was work with the artists and basically give it to them at cost. They could write it off as an advertising expense. Each magazine had a copy of anywhere between 4 and 6 songs by different artists, so they could not only read about these artists but also hear about the music. If they were in towns where they didn't have any kind of a feminist or a gay radio show, and most of our readers did not have that luxury, most of our readers were not anywhere near where a festival was held. Most of them did not have a bookstore in their town that carried, you know, feminist or lesbian music. This, in many ways, was their only way of hearing it. And of course, it is all about the music. The writing was great, but the reality is it's a live, performing, living thing. And if you can't hear it, it doesn't mean anything. So those were great. And over the 10 years that we published, and beyond, actually, that was one of the things we got the best feedback on. You know, I think back to doing Hotwire, and it's like, ay, 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 how do we even do it? First of all, when we started, we didn't have desktop publishing. We didn't even have a computer. We typed the issue by hand. Then we moved on to having access in the middle of the night if we wanted to go to a typesetting machine at a local gay newspaper. So volunteers would go and do that. We had a couple women who worked for a local newspaper, a mainstream newspaper, who would, in the middle of the night, go and do halftones for us. Then there was the revolutionary thing of desktop publishing that came in, but still no email. And it's like, when I look today at how easy it is to transfer material, whole files, scan, digital, everything, it's like, wow, man, we could really do the magazine now. And it amazes me that was a publication that was put together by basically 40 women at any given time working in somebody's basement for free at night.
How did Hotwire change or evolve over the years?
It evolved in several ways, big ways. certainly it got better looking with every single issue. When we stopped typing it, we went to typesetting. That looked way better. Then, of course, the desktop publishing gives you much more control over it looking more professional yet. We got better at the halftones. By the time we got to the 30th issue, it was something that I feel anyone could be really proud of. It's a very professional looking thing. In terms of content, it evolved along with women's music. By 1994, we not only had an extremely well-developed 20 years of women's music recordings, performances, festivals, publications, etc., radio shows, but we also had made a lot of major inroads into the mainstream entertainment industry. And that, in fact, is part of the reason Hotwire needed to stop. It wasn't possible to go on and have it be a quality publication and cover as much as we were having to cover. In the 10 years that we had been going, everybody else kept wanting to come to the party, so you had all the same old entertainers and things that you ever had, for the most part, but every single 6 months brought new entertainers and in different genres, and it got to the point where we simply could not cover everything from Ronnie Gilbert all the way down to the latest punk band, all the way to the kinds of writing and zines that were happening, and all the stuff that was going on, you know, on mainstream TV, and you know, women like Melissa Etheridge and Katie Lang coming out, and all the great gay stuff that Roseanne had on her show, and on and on and on. It became impossible without actually having a paid staff who could do nothing but focus on that. And rather than sacrifice the quality of what we had always done, we decided, really, it's time to stop. That the women's music era that magazine represented was coming to an end. It was a bitter pill to swallow, but I think we were realistic. I was looking, just out of curiosity, I was looking recently at my old Women's Music Plus directories and thinking, you know, about publications, how did that actually evolve? Because I knew you and I'd be talking about it for your show, and I was kind of curious. So I got them all out, and I was looking. Now, not counting songbooks, but including things like directories, okay? In 1977, there were 21 publications in my directory, which was called We Shall Go Forth at that time. The whole directory was only 28 pages, but there was 21 publications listed. By 1979, there were already 31 that were specifically having to do with feminist arts type things, feminist music. By 1982, it had grown to 122 that I listed, and these are just ones that I knew about on my own little Rolodex list. There were 65 newspapers and newsletters, 24 directories and music resources like the Lady Slipper catalog, 33 magazines and journals about art and culture, and by 1984, there were 213 already. It was just unbelievable to me how it just grew and grew and grew. And they were really an interesting bunch, too. Again, there's the stereotype of the, you know, granola dyke kind of thing, and it's just the facts don't back up that stereotype, really. Although the stereotype is a tribute to women like Kay Gardner with her flute and Ginny Clemons with her guitar and Margie Adam with her piano, and that those women were very effective. Certainly, and they deserve their place in history. But some of the magazines that I found that were really interesting were like Off Our Backs, a very political publication from Washington, D.C., Onyx, Black Women's Newsletter from San Francisco, Better Homes and Dykes from Iowa City, Big Mama Rag from Colorado, the International League of Women Composers Newsletter in Virginia. They were all over the country, and they were all about all sorts of different things. It was very expansive, and yet all focused on women, which always brings us back to, well, what is women's music? All of this is women's music. It's all by, for, and about women. It's woman identified. I also was kind of curious about festivals. You know, having lived it for 30 years at this point, it all blurs together in a way. There's certain big ones that I think everybody's heard of, like Michigan and maybe Sister Fire. So what was there? What did I have listed there in 1977? There were 10 of them. Two of them that are still with us, of course, the National Women's Music Festival in Michigan. And can never say those names enough because they're great festivals. But also, there were festivals in Portland, Oregon, Kansas City, the Jazz Festival, Long Island, New York, Montana, Boston, Colorado, Pennsylvania, and Toronto. So even back then, by 77, things were really all over the place and not just California and New York by any means. Okay, here's something. I really feel like common folklore misses a big piece of the historical picture, and that is the role that the Midwest has played in all of this. It's true. Chicago, the Midwest in general, did not produce a lot of big-name entertainment stars. Certainly, Jenny Clemons came from Chicago. The Washington Sisters came from Ohio. Soraya Carroll's from here. But that's not really what the Midwest is so famous for. What we did is provide the infrastructure. When we look back over the last 30 years, much of the spine of the whole industry came out of the Midwest. Again, our favorite festivals, Michigan and National, both of them Midwest. National down in, started in Illinois, moved to Indiana, is now in Ohio. The Michigan Festival stayed in Michigan. One of the two distributors that's left out of the 50 is Goldenrod, and they're in Michigan. Lesbian Connection, the hugely distributed newsletter for lesbians that's something like 30 years old already, you know, it's in Michigan too. Mountain Moving Coffee House is the oldest ongoing women's performance space that still is collectively run. It's still on a sliding scale. It's still for women born women. It's still a drug-free, sober space. That's been here, and countless women have performed. In its heyday, it had 40 shows a year, and countless touring women have come through here. Hotwire was published from here. Paid My Dues was published from here. Paid My Dues was published in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. We also have provided so many of the workers for all these different things that have gone on. We've had radio shows here that were gay. We have one of the larger gay publications, Windy City Times, formerly called Outlines, that has always been extremely inclusive of lesbian feminist arts stuff, which most gay newspapers really aren't. There may be some token coverage, but this has always been truly not the focus of the paper, but included. So I feel like the Midwest has been really fantastic.
I know you could answer this question with hundreds of names, but can you tell me about a women's music artist who is vastly underappreciated?
I agree with you that I could give you a lot of names. I don't think I could give you hundreds, because I think women's music was an extremely open venue. If you wanted to try to play or sing, then you could do it, and you could be terrible. But you'd find an audience, and the audience would give you support and encouragement, because it was the feminist thing to do. It was the loving thing to do, as opposed to the mainstream, where it's all just claw your way to the top, and everybody's going to control how you look and what you say and package you. You know, women's music has never been that. It's never been about the packaging. It's been about the substance. So I think that many of the women who are underrated are never really made it for a reason. Either musically they're not that good, or vocally, or the lyrics just aren't that deep. Whatever. I do think that there's an entertainer that I've been watching for the last several years that I highly recommend to anyone who's interested, and that's Nedra Johnson. Her stuff is very cutting edge. It's got a great sound. It's sort of an R&B blues gospel kind of a thing. She's real political, funny. She has two albums out. The first one's called Testify. The second one, which is new, is called Nedra. And in fact, this new one, I just love this song she has called Any Way You Need Her. Nedra's one of the few in women's music that's ever head-on approached and included religious imagery in her lyrics. Not in the sense that she's going to sing old gospel tunes, but her whole position is, you know, God made me gay. How dare you try to take God away from me? How dare you? And I think that she, in many ways, represents the new millennium where women's music is going.
You know, there's many religions in the world, and people call on God in all kinds of different ways, and I believe it's by the intentions of your heart. God will hear your call. So all you gotta do is call. In any way you need God, I believe in my heart God will come.
Any way you need her, she will come.
Yeah.
Any way you need her, she will come.
Oh yes, by the intentions of your heart,
know that you can call on God, and any way you need her, she will come. That's why I say Jesus is a lesbian, and any way you need her, she will come. And if for you to see the light, you got to be male, long blonde hair and white. Sing hallelujah, I know she'll come.
In the old days, the old days of women's music, it was, you couldn't get your flyers printed if you had the word lesbian on it. You couldn't get a venue to rent to you. You couldn't come out at work. You were afraid your parents and your friends were going to find out you were gay if you went to a Michigan festival, so you had to lie about where you were going. I mean, it's just so unbelievable. You couldn't get recorded if you had lesbian lyrics or if you weren't feminine enough. Blah, blah, blah. Okay, so women's music really pulled into an entire universe of its own and created its own festivals and its own publications and its own recording labels and its own everything. You know what? Fine. You don't want us? We want us. And we're going to have our own thing, and we're not going to let you stop. Now I think in the new millennium, where all of it is going with groups like Bitch and Animal, Together and Separately, Nidra, Alex Olsen, different acts that are out there now, the gay movement and the feminist movements have moved everything along far enough that we're at the door now with a foot in the door of getting mainstream recognition, not just in entertainment, but also domestic partnership benefits in corporations, gay marriage, of course, the formation of all these gay straight alliances in the high schools, whoever saw that coming, on and on. No more do people want to sit back and form their own little private world. They really want to go out and say, look, I want everything my taxes are paying for, and I want the respect that comes with it. I don't want to be straight like you. I don't want to pretend to be straight like you in any way, but you know what? I want all my rights, and I want to be here. And I think that Nidra's work really addresses that in a way that the women's music of the 70s addressed where feminism and the gay movement were at back then.
Would you talk a moment about the current state of publications about women's music?
Well, I do actually. As we're moving on into the new millennium, I actually have a few favorites of today that aren't musical. There's three in particular that I guess I could recommend pretty wholeheartedly. Number one is Rocker Girl, rockrgrl.com, if you want to check them out. They've been going since 1995. Their publisher, Carla DeSantis, has done with Rocker Girl for women in rock a lot of what Hotwire did for women in women's music, which is to put women first, to really focus on being an alternative, independent voice. They do include men much more because they're not a separatist publication, but the articles are never about men. It might be men in the band of a woman who is being featured, that kind of thing. They come out six times a year, and I think they're great. They're really political in addition to musical, and I just love that. Another one that's not so focused on music but that I just adore is called Bitch, Feminist Response to Pop Culture. And they're basically, they've been around since 96. They come out of Oakland. They do commentary on basically critiques of TV and magazines, advertising. They do music interviews and basically cool, smart women in all areas of pop culture. I think that they're a great, you know, nothing really took the place of Hotwire. But those two magazines together satisfy me in terms of covering a lot of the same territory. Although my favorite things, which are the lesbian and feminist music festivals, are rarely covered by anyone now, which is sad. The third thing I would recommend is on a much smaller scale, but still fun. It's called Wig Mag. Women in general, Wig. Wigmag.com, the new world forum for fierce women in general. It's just got a lot of fun pop culture stuff from a feminist point of view.
Please tell me about your own musical contributions to the movement.
My primary contributions to women's music have never been personal. They've been my ability to organize the bigger picture and provide, for example, a magazine or produce a concert. However, I did have my share of performing times. It's been pretty fun. I was in a band in this in the early 70s, mid-70s, called Starkist, which was a lesbian a punk band. And that was pretty different for those times. In looking back, there weren't hardly any bands like that. We just played in Chicago. I was in another band called Surrender Dorothy, which went for 3 or 4 years here in Chicago as well. And it was really pretty popular in its day. We performed mostly music that was written by Paula Wolowitz. Several of her songs have gone on to more prominence elsewhere. And I was in a little group called the Dental Damsels for a while. Most of the stuff that I was involved with never got recorded. I think that there's a pretty lo-fi version of a song on the High Risk CD done with Paula Wolowitz. Goddess's Rage, or Neopaganomics, we called it, that has become kind of popular in the Wiccan circles. And there was also a song, one of my favorites, called Surprise, that was recorded on Gay and Straight Together, on Ginny Clemons' Open Door label. That song, in fact, was written by Paula at a time when I had already started working at this high school where I still work, and it was just so painful to not be able to come out at work. And part of her song is, I'm looking forward to the day when I can say, surprise, I'm gay, and the people at work will smile and say, that's great. Where are we going to lunch today? And it was such a dream back then that it could ever be like that. And just recently, I went to Canada and got married so that I could be legally married. And 50 of my colleagues at the high school where I work got together and gave me a wedding shower at school in the principal's conference room. And it's mind-boggling to play that song now and remember that exact same job back then, and how, wow, everything has just changed so much, more than the mind can even embrace.
Are you married? Well, no. Then you're single. Suppose so. At least that's what it's called, I understand. Oh, I'll bet, wink, wink, that you're living with your boyfriend. Well, I got an open mind. Well, no. In fact, my roommate is a very good woman, friend of mine. Surprise, I'm a lesbian, and goodness, here I am again, dodging all the questions while staying on my toes. Surprise, I'm a lesbian, explaining why there is no man in my life. I'm a loner, I suppose. When actually I've been living my life with the person of my dreams, and though I should keep it under my hat, there are times when I want to scream. Surprise, I'm a lesbian, and goodness, here I am again, dodging all the questions while staying on my toes. Surprise, I'm a lesbian, explaining why there is no man in my life. I'm a loner, I suppose. I'm looking forward to the day when I can say, surprise, I'm gay, and the people at work will smile and say, that's nice. Where are we going to lunch today? Surprise, I'm a lesbian, being only as I am, as I've chosen to be. A woman, loving woman, standing up against the lies and sharing her delightful surprise. Oh, I'm looking forward to the day when I can say, surprise, I'm gay, and the people at work will smile and say, that's great, let's go out and celebrate. Surprise, I'm a lesbian, being only as I am, being as I've chosen to be. A woman, loving woman, standing up against the lies and sharing her delightful surprise.
You've also made major contributions to women's music as a photographer.
Yeah, I have been a photographer all along. It was sort of a hobby, and during the Hotwire years, to be honest with you, it was really impossible to afford photos that we'd have to pay for. So there were a couple of us on staff who went ahead and took them all because we wouldn't have to be paid for our work. And I'm really glad because now I have thousands and thousands and thousands of these images. Many of them were used in a book called Eden Built by Eves by Bonnie Morris. And I have thought over time, many people have said, why don't you publish a book or a calendar with all these photos? I just think that it wouldn't be that much of a seller, to be honest. But lately, within the last few months, some women in town have been talking about starting a Hotwire website, now that the technology is what it is on the internet, that would give downloadable versions of every article and every photo that ever was in the magazine, along with the sound sheet clips in MP3 format. We're working out the technical details of how, if you use PDF files, then you can't really scan for individual words, right, and for a search function. So we want people to be able to come to the site, search for, say, Willie Tyson or Ginny Clemens or the East Coast Lesbians Festival or Goldenrod Distribution, and have every reference that ever was come up, and then direct them to downloadable PDF files that would have all the pictures and everything with it. So that's sort of my next project. And I really look forward to that.
Wow, that would really be terrific. What other projects have you been involved in?
One of the most recent things that I produced that I'm very proud of is a large-scale day devoted to the historic contributions of lesbian feminist women's music that was sponsored by the Chicago Historical Society. This was in September of 2004, and they are the first mainstream historical society in the country to ever step forward and say, gosh, we really think that lesbian feminist music changed the course of American history. Let's take a look at that in a mainstream way of appreciating it. So we had a day of panel discussions and performances. We had the reunion of my band Surrender Dorothy. We had Ubaka Hill, Kristen Lems, who of course was the founder of the first National Women's Music Festival, and an entertainer to this day. She's still making recordings. It was just, there were producers. It was a great day. And just as these things work out, it was so interesting. In September of 1984, a bunch of young women thought, wow, let's get a barn and put on a show. And we said, we'll just do our own little magazine. That'll be great. It'll be great. Oh my God, if only we knew. And it was great. And then in September of 1994, it was time for that to stop, and we put Hotwire to bed. And then in September of 2004, the Chicago Historical Society comes forward and asks us to, you know, tell everybody how lesbian feminist music has changed the course of American history. So I can't wait for September of 2014 and to see just what amazing things have happened by then.
Do you have any last words for my listeners?
Something that really interests me as both as a historian and somebody who lived through the history that's being talked about or written about is what gets emphasized and what doesn't. And sometimes people really do miss the forest for the trees. Sue Fink, an artist that I really have always appreciated, once was talking about women's music isn't the music. It isn't a form of music. Women's music is an audience. I think that that is exactly right. No, we didn't exactly produce Melissa Etheridge, although she did, in fact, play at early women's music festivals. No, we didn't produce Tracy Chapman, but I have photos of her at Michigan and National. You know, we didn't produce the stars. However, we produced the audience that was there for the stars when they were ready to step up and come out. We produced way more than a taste for out gay music or out feminist music. Every time women went to a women's music festival, they were changed by the politics. They went home and they were less likely to accept racism or sexism on the job. They were more likely to say, how come we don't have a sign language interpreter here? They were more likely to think about what's going on in their community and how they could be better and different. And it just has permeated hundreds and thousands of lives and made changes all across the board. And so you're beginning to see interesting things now as this sort of young generation turns into older women. one of the fun things that I've been involved in lately is everybody's looking around at the Red Hat Society, and my basically 80-year-old lesbian mom in California belongs to a Red Hat Society chapter, and she was having so much fun. And I thought, oh, that's something that I could do here in Chicago. You have to be 50. It's to celebrate women that are over 50, the accomplishments and wonderfulness of women over 50. And I thought, well, that fits right in with that, my whole lesbian feminist life. So I started here in Chicago the first openly lesbian Red Hat chapter called the Amazon Lesbian Red Hat Sisterhood. I wanted to make sure it was as clear as possible what we were. And our theme song is Lynn Lavner's I Like Older Women.
Keep all your cuties untested and tried. Build them a playground and lock them inside. I've a yen for the female whose war has been waged like a steak has been properly seasoned and aged. I don't care for the chippies at all. I want their mothers to call. Oh, I like older women. I like the grown-up kind. Give me a stable adult, not the teens in their jeans and what's a Madonna. Youth is a pain in the ass. I like my Coke in a glass. Oh, I like older women, and I hope that they like me too.
That was Lynn Lavner and her song Older Women. You can hear a whole interview with her on my show from March of 2003.
Hi, this is Holly Neer.
Hi,
this is Chris Williamson.
This is Margie Adam.
And you are listening to Queer Music Heritage on KBFT Houston.
And this is a good time to invite you to check out my website at www.queermusicheritage.com. If you visit it while you're listening, you can see the playlist and follow along while looking at photos of the artists and recordings. I've always considered our music history as a visual as well as an audio experience. And both of the women featured on tonight's show gave me wonderful interviews, so good that I cannot possibly fit it all into an hour's show. So you can hear an expanded version of the show at my website, with a lot more songs and comments. Also, for more very queer programming, please listen to After Hours with Jimmy Carper, now in its new time every Friday night, Saturday morning from 1 to 4 a.m. on KPFT. It's queer radio with attitude.